Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, on air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet. I'm Ryan from Mueliner. Next month, the Missouri Symphony Society will start its annual Hot Summer Nights Music Festival. This year's lineup features more than 20 performances spanning a variety of genres. That list includes traditional classical and opera, as well as more contemporary fare, including tributes to Michael Jackson and Elton John. There will also be a number of kid-friendly events, including one highlighting the connections between pizza and music. This type of diverse lineup is becoming more common across the country as symphonies attempt to court a younger audience to remain financially stable. Today on Intersection, we'll talk about the future of symphony orchestras and get a preview of this year's Hot Summer Nights Festival. Joining me in the studio to discuss these and other issues, Kirk Trevor is the music director and conductor of the Missouri Symphony Society. He's also the artistic director of the Hot Summer Nights Music Festival. Thanks for being here, Kirk.
Thank you very much indeed.
And Chris Campbell is the executive director of Missouri Symphony Society. He's held that position since February this year. Thanks for being here, Chris.
You're welcome.
And for you and our audience, what performances are you most looking forward to this year? Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia, or you could join our online chat. And so, Kirk, maybe I'd like to start with you here just to talk about what you're really looking forward to this year with the Hot Summer Nights Festival. I mean, what's new, I guess, this year?
I don't think it's a question of what's new. We have a template that seems to get us started in terms of the different series that we have. I think what's new is always going to be the freshness of the repertoire, new artists appearing, hopefully new audiences appearing. Obviously, the orchestra has a little changeover every year. So I think the exciting time for us is always right at the beginning when we're putting together the orchestra coming from all across the United States and meeting for the first few days and seeing kind of how we're going to fit together. And what we try to do in the first 4 or 5 days is put together a lot of repertoire because we have 24 concerts. And so putting together at the beginning, at the front of the festival, we try to cover a lot of the repertoire that we're going to be performing during the year.
Sure. And for those that don't know, the symphony is made up of about 50 members from all over the country.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so for many of them, is this the first time they've played together, or?
No, well, I mean, it's the reality is that a lot of them come from Florida and Texas and Arkansas simply because of the way word of mouth has spread. So some of them play in orchestras together in Florida and Arkansas and Texas. And then we have, of course, including a number of musicians from Columbia and Missouri. But it will be the first time they've come together since last year. Yeah, sure.
And so you mentioned in there some of maybe new audiences you might try to attract. What are some examples of who you're trying to attract, I guess, maybe with some of the performers this year?
Well, I don't want to sound like, you know, if you start to focus on one group, you seem to be excluding another. So,
sure.
I mean, I think obviously, and I'm sure you're going to discuss this at some point, the term younger when we're talking about symphony orchestras may be, you know, referring to 45-year-olds as opposed to the traditional symphony orchestra audience. But I think the word younger for us is going to be really a whole cross-section. Obviously, we would like to see at our family concerts lots of young families together, having the opportunity to share music together and their first experiences. In our pop concerts, obviously the music of Elton John and Michael Jackson will appeal to a different demographic than Beethoven and Brahms. And so it's probably in the classical area that we're most interested in trying to reach out to people who think that we're a bit stuffy and elite and try and make them feel comfortable in the environment that we have here at the Missouri Theater and at other locations around town. And I think that's the biggest problem we all face in symphony orchestras, and we're no different from any others, is that there are preconceptions that come with the territory. Brahms and Beethoven tend to make kids roll their eyes. And, you know, Lady Gaga and you know, Psy, which we also play, probably would get a different kind of reaction. And so what we're trying to do, not only in the summer, but throughout the year, is to give the impression that the symphony is really a much broader and wider-ranging repertoire, perhaps a little cooler than people might expect.
Yeah. So I didn't know that you guys are playing Lady Gaga and Psy. Where is that fitting into this year, Hot Summer Nights? Or
Well, we'll find. We have both Gangnam Style and Edge of Glory in our repertoire.
Wow.
Where we'll use them, I'm not too sure. I don't think we'll put them between Brahms and Beethoven necessarily.
Sure.
But I just probably will do them in family concerts. You know, it seems to be a logical place to embrace the parents and some young kids. Some of that music will be performed by young kids. In fact, in our conservatory this year, our conservatory kids, which are third through eighth graders, played Lady Gaga, and our eighth through 12th graders play Gangnam Style.
And that seems a pretty easy way to get them interested, I suppose.
Well, I think they were interested, they're interested to be in a great orchestra, a young orchestra, youth orchestra program. But I think they're much more surprised that I would program something like Lady Gaga or Gangnam Style. But my whole philosophy is that it's important for us, if we're trying to embrace young performers of the future, that we allow them to perform the music of their own time. You know, of course, Beethoven and Brahms are important in their own development, but they have also a voice, and their voice might be Psy and Lady Gaga rather than, Bernstein and Barber in my time and maybe Elton John in Chris's time. I don't know.
Well, yeah, and Chris, I'd like to bring you in too. I guess you mentioned it earlier, a second ago, Chris, the idea of – or Kirk, the idea of maybe the perception of a stuffy symphony or that idea that maybe it's elitist or something like that. Maybe your thoughts on that and how you can maybe combat that as through programming, I guess. You've already mentioned a few examples of things that kind of fly in the face of that.
Sure. And that's going to be one of our biggest goals moving forward long term, is finding a younger audience. And as Kirk said, that's what every orchestra in the country is searching for, and programming is probably the largest component of how we go about that. And Kirk's already doing a great job and has been for years of doing that, but it also has to move forward with a particular marketing and branding style and marketing and branding tactics. And so we're going to be looking at that very hard and doing everything we can over the next, not just this year, but several years, to bring in that younger audience in any way that we can.
Okay. I want to take one moment to remind our listeners that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Fumuller, and today we've got the folks behind the Hot Summer Nights Festival here in studio. We're talking about this year's program and talking about the future of symphonic orchestras in mid-Missouri and beyond. Joining me in studio are Kirk Trevor, the music director and conductor of the Missouri Symphony Society, and he's the artistic director of the Hot Summer Nights Music Festival, and Chris Campbell, he's the executive director of Missouri Symphony Society. And for you and our audience, are you a fan of classical music? How were you first exposed to it? We'd like to hear what you think. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. We'd like to remind you that Intersection is presented as streaming video during our live conversations every Monday afternoon at 2 online at kbia.org. You can watch that video and join our online chat by going to kbia.org and scrolling down to the link for Intersection. Again, that's Mondays at 2 online at kbia.org. I wanted to take a minute to bring in a clip from one of the performers this year. Jenny Oakes Baker is going to be here. That is June 29th, doing a show called An American Soundtrack. Mm-hmm. And so maybe we'll just play the clip and maybe we can talk a little bit after that. But this clip is actually A Whole New World, which may sound familiar to some people in our audience.
Thank you.
So Ginny Oaks Baker, a Grammy-nominated performer.
Yep.
But again, playing a piece that is not one of the classics, I guess, if you will. So for those longtime classical supporters, how do you introduce a piece like this without alienating them?
This is actually Jenny going to perform on our pop series rather than our classical series, even though she's playing the violin, which is, I think we're going to have another clip of another violinist who is going to be on the classical series. But, you know, one of the things I think that is important for people to realize is that as much as symphony orchestras are trying to reach out to in the more popular fields and the more popular forms of music, we are what we are. We are a symphony orchestra. We're not a rock band. And so the embracing of popular music into our genre has to be done with some integrity. And so I think that Jenny is a great example of somebody who brings popular music through the classical medium, so to speak. I mean, the violin, look, there's lots of great, jazz violinists, pop violinists out there. Jenny is one of the best out there that we have. And so by incorporating her into a program that embraces Walt Disney and movie music and Americana, we're hoping that people will give us a taste by coming to a concert that really is a crossover program between many different styles. Movies, of course, incorporate a lot of contemporary classical music. Disney's cartoons, I mean, our whole season is a bit about crossover. And so using Jenny is a great, I think, bridge between our two styles that we have as a symphony orchestra. Obviously, we can break down and perform mariachi, we could perform jazz, we did in our holiday program this Christmas. But I hope we won't alienate anybody, through, I think by playing popular music. And we have to remember that Mozart was pop music at one time, Beethoven was pop music. I mean, the word popular, it tends to have created a division, and I hate the word classical music. I think it's that we try to talk about good music and not so good music.
So is that the word we should use, just good, or what would you call it instead?
Well, I mean, I would say that popular music should be good. I mean, I think all music, it's like the term world music. You know, we try to be a little more embracing, and this classical term has become the way of elitism, I think, and that's what I'm trying to break away from. So I think Jenny, by performing really so many different styles, and our orchestra is incredibly versatile in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Chris, I'd like to hear your thoughts too on kind of just this balance, I guess, when again in programming and trying to keep. I mean, I don't know if it's keeping everybody happy or if it's just trying to draw as many people in as possible.
And I should say, sorry, but to interrupt, Ryan, it's also about environment and the way you present. Obviously, in the classical programs, you have maybe three pieces that the orchestra can play, a symphony, a concerto, an overture. There's certainly a different experience for the audience than a pop program, which might have 20 to 24 pieces in it. And so it's a way we present music, I think, that's important. And Chris will speak a little to that, I think, about production values and the way we present music, I think, will be the way that we can reach out to this audience.
Sure. Well, a couple of thoughts come to mind. I know a term that both Kirk and I like, as opposed to classical music, is symphonic music.
Oh, sure.
Because that's who we are and what we are. We're a symphony orchestra. And what's wonderful about that and easy to remind people is that symphonic music has been with all of us for all of our lives. When we go to these fantastic Disney films, which have been so good and so popular over the last 20 or 25 years, we're hearing, whether it's by Tim Rice and Elton John or something borrowed from the past, we're hearing symphonic music. And that's certainly not elitist, and that's something that everybody warms to. And going back to the bridge and how people who are patrons and subscribers to the classics, and we'll call them the classic composers of yesteryear, when it comes to someone like Ginny Oaks Baker, what's really wonderful about programming her this summer is that she commands immediate and tremendous respect from all of our classical fans because she's the former first chair of the National Symphony Orchestra, which is saying something. What's interesting about her Grammy nomination is that it was for an album, and correct me if I'm wrong, Kirk, of all Disney tunes. So she is going to – and the reason we entitled this evening an American soundtrack – She loves playing rock music. She loves playing inspirational favorites. She loves playing the Disney scores. And she's going to bring all that to the table that night. And I think those who normally go to our classical concerts and are in love with all of that programming, they're going to be there too because they respect what a terrific musician she is.
And so I guess on the same idea, I guess, why do you think that we're talking about this younger audience. Why do you think that pop music or music from these films is more accessible, I guess? And do you think it's really possible for – how realistic is it for somebody to get that entry point of this pop music and then, you know, find love for this more classical genre?
I think it's again, about presentation. I mean, the old saying that's going around at the moment among symphony orchestras, it's not Beethoven that's a problem, it's the way we present Beethoven that's a problem. And I think that, you know, in Indianapolis with my orchestra there, we're looking at a whole new series that starts at 10:30 at night in a jazz bar. And hopefully, you know, attracting an audience that and providing taxis for audiences to go home afterwards, you know, come, enjoy yourself, have a beer, listen to the orchestra play at midnight. I mean, it's about environment. I think that as I talk to more and more 20-somethings, I find that their interaction is about space, the place they're in. You know, it's about the way they interact on Facebook or Twitter or how they talk to each other and where they meet. And, you know, they get together and they don't go to 7:30 concert. They go to stuff at 10:30 at night, you know. Mm-hmm. And so we're looking at that. So I think it's about the space and the environment, and that's why we don't want to necessarily limit ourselves only to the Missouri Theater, but to try to find other spaces.
What are some examples? I know we've got parks this year.
We've got parks, of course. We've got libraries. We've got senior citizens activity centers. Hopefully more and more spaces will appear as, you know, I remember a few years ago we played at the Blue Note. And, you know, maybe that's a logical place for us to play if we have a 10:30 at night series. This is a process, as Tiger Woods would say. You know, it's not going to happen this year, all in one year. It's going to take 5 years now that Chris is on board, and we certainly see eye to eye about the future and the way that the Missouri Symphonies need to move forward. But it's about letting the whole community know that we have something for everybody.
And we do have a lot of work to do, and as Kirk said, to underline that, it won't happen overnight, but already I'm looking at young professional organizations in Columbia and mid-Missouri that I want to reach out to and create relationships with. Kirk pointed out production value and presentation. You know, the Missouri Theater works in two different ways. A, for a lot of people, it's just incredibly gorgeous, fantastic, and me included, place to come see a show that is a star by itself. And for other people, frankly, there are going to be some, and there are some, that atmosphere is going to be intimidating to them. That's not necessarily where they want to go hear their music. If they're more comforted by being in the environs of Mojo's, then we have to work to bridge that gap. And before we get to a place where we can afford, you know, to bring in Adele or Mumford and Sons or Alabama Shakes to front the symphony.
Or fun.
Exactly. And someday, trust me, we want to get there. But in the meantime, Kirk's right. And I've been studying other orchestras around the country, and hopefully in the next couple of years we'll start, if not next year, looking at ways to mix up the presentation. I know some orchestras are suggesting that Kirk and I haven't even talked about this, but it's worth thinking about. Some orchestras around the country are trying to provide a nightclub scene just to bring in a crowd who will listen. Now, that's not to say you want to take anything away from the music, because you've gotten nowhere if in the end they can't appreciate the music. But if it means providing more of a nightclub scene, you know, in our venues, allowing people to, for instance, chat during performances, which some symphony orchestras are experimenting with right now, or making sure that there are lots of cold, adult alcoholic beverages. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of different ways to go about this, and We'll be looking at all of that as time goes
and
on.
And I wonder what the members of the symphony think of that, because you are talking about breaking some unwritten rules, if you will, and things like that in traditional symphonies, I guess, if there's such a thing. But well, what do you think, what do members think?
Well, I mean, we have an orchestra that's relatively young. I mean, I would say the average age of the orchestra is probably 35, 40. And in classical music terms, that's pretty young. I think that musicians are all just feel the same way. You know, we all are aware of the dangers that we face in a profession that is becoming increasingly jeopardized. So they realize, I mean, as more and more young performers come out of colleges realizing that they can't just play Bach and Beethoven, that they're going to have to embrace, you know, jazz, country fiddle. My daughter, who we'll probably see a little later, will play Shostakovich here at the first concert, but she has been taking lessons in bluegrass from Mark O'Connor, jazz, trying to write her own music, a little like Jenny Oakes Baker. You can't be very narrow anymore as a musician. I mean, even Sting, you know, has worked the same way. He realizes you can't just be one thing. You have to be much broader to make that bridge with people who, generally themselves, have started with fairly narrow listening trends. And I think that the reason that people cross over from one trend to the other is that they see artists who have done some crossover, you know, Sting going classical and some Yo-Yo Ma going bluegrass. I think these kinds of things are important for a musician. So I think the broader we can remain, the better.
Yeah. I want to take another minute to remind our listeners that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Femuliner, and today we've got the folks behind the Hot Summer Nights Festival in studio. We're talking about this year's program and talking about the future of symphonic orchestras in mid-Missouri and beyond. Joining me in studio are Kurt Trevor, the music director and conductor of the Missouri Symphony Society, and he's the artistic director of the Hot Summer Nights Music Festival, and Chris Campbell, he's the executive director of the Missouri Symphony Society. And for you and our audience, if you are planning the Hot Summer Nights Festival, what performances or compositions would you try to book? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. We did have a question from the chat room that I wanted to get to. They were wondering if there are any interesting or obscure instruments that participate in the festival.
Well, that's something I'm trying to think this year, obscure, interesting or obscure. Probably not this year. I mean, we've had some pretty obscure in past, and I certainly was looking at when we had our, I guess we would call it Middle Eastern program, we had a lot of Iranian instruments and some Turkish, and that was our world music series back in 2009. This year I'm staying fairly traditional. Within the orchestra, I guess a banjo, electric guitar will be there. Mm-hmm. We're looking at some, actually American-made, we've just been discussing with a wonderful company here in town, Davis Mueller Instruments, about their wonderful digital keyboard, which is a very unusual and fantastic instrument. We hope we're going to have that on stage. But I've been looking at things like, you know, the pipa, which is a wonderful Chinese instrument. Obviously, people have asked me, with such a huge international community here, whether we would get a little more world music oriented. But with the trouble for us is that a lot of the international students are gone during the summer. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's part of that demographics is gone. Yeah.
Sure. Well, I wanted to take another minute to play another clip that we had ready. Angie Zhang is going to be here this summer, somebody I think that you guys are very excited about.
Yeah.
Again, we'll have you talk about her after. But she's playing here Shadrine's Basso Ostinato. She played it at WGBH Studios in Boston.
Thank you.
So Angie Jung, obviously a very talented performer.
So
she'll be here, I think, on July 6th.
Angie is really, I guess we can call her a child prodigy. I mean, she's still only 17. Making a huge impact on the piano scene here in the United States. And I found her because I was looking for a young pianist. I've always been a believer in young performers. And that part of our festival, you know, you talk about how to get young audiences. Obviously, you want to have performers that that they can identify with, you know. And so by having young performers under 30, for instance, is certainly going to be a way in which we can say, look, you know, you don't have to be old and antiquated to be great in the world of symphonic music.
Symphonic.
And Angie, of course, represents the new generation of young performers and also represents the best in kind of the new wave of intellectual musicians. Angie is not only a composer, an incredible pianist, she also talks on music, writes about music, has her own blog. You know, this whole ability to be an advocate and to be so eloquent about music, I think it's just so admirable what young musicians are doing.
Well, and education and bringing in youth, that's a big mission of the Missouri Symphony Society.
Of course, right?
So, I mean, what are some of the other things that you try to do, both through Hot Summer Nights, but just in general?
Well, year-round we have the conservatory program, which is 153 young musicians who make up two orchestras and a children's chorus, and they rehearse every week. Give about 10 concerts throughout the year. This program was started in 2007, has grown by leaps and bounds, has now really taken over our offices and to a point that we have to really kind of think about getting more staff involved with it because it's so big. But I think the unique thing about our conservatory program is that we try to not make it just a performance-oriented program where kids just practice every week and give a concert. We try to embrace the history of music, theory, conducting, eurythmics, try to get kids to understand that there's so much more that they need to understand about what they're doing rather than just playing notes. And so we hope that they have fun doing it and try to make the whole experience of playing and singing together a joyous one.
Yeah, and Chris, from the programming perspective, how do you strike that balance, I guess, between having some of these new programs, family-oriented programs as well?
Well, for instance, the conservatory camp, a summer camp that we're doing every year now, it's called the Joy of Music Summer Camp. They're going to be an integral part of Hot Summer Nights because while that camp goes on June 24th through June 30th, they will also be involved in two performances that week at the Missouri Theater with the Symphony Orchestra. So that's one way we're definitely bridging it, is making sure that those conservatory kids and the kids who are in the camp thinking about joining the conservatory right from the get-go have the opportunity to be on that incredible stage with professional musicians. And that brings in families who might not normally come see Hot Summer Nights. Yeah. That maybe brings in brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles. And that's how we create that bridge in one way.
Okay. We're going to take a short break. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we've got the folks behind the Hot Summer Nights Festival here in studio. We're talking about this year's program. We'll be right back after a short break. Welcome back to Intersection. This is a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Femuelner, and next month the Missouri Symphony Society will start its annual Hot Summer Nights Music Festival. This year's lineup features more than 20 performances spanning a variety of genres. Today we're talking about this year's program and talking about the future of symphonic orchestras in mid-Missouri and beyond. Joining me in studio are Kirk Trevor, the music director and conductor of the Missouri Symphony Society, and he's the artistic director of the Hot Summer Nights Music Festival, and Chris Campbell, he's the executive director of the Missouri Symphony Society. For you and our audience, how could classical music reach new audiences? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia or join our online chat. And Kirk, maybe to open up this half hour, we do have another clip that maybe if you could introduce it for us that we'd like to play.
This is actually the performer on the opening concert of our season, or the opening classical concert called White Russian Nights, and this is the violinist Chloe Trevor, who happened to be my daughter. And this is a clip of her playing another Russian piece, the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto with the Dallas Symphony a couple of years ago.
So yes, again, that performance from your daughter, Kirk. So yeah. I guess, again, that probably fits into that mold we were talking about before the break about having something relatable to a younger audience.
I hope so. I mean, obviously, having a young performer entices young people who may want to be young musicians themselves, and somebody that they can identify with, somebody who has gone through their same experience and not far removed from it. I think that that's much better for us as an orchestra to present people who are closely related to the audience that we're trying to reach.
And how do the artists, the performers, feel about this, I guess, outreach mechanism, since education, again, is a very big part of what the Symphony Society does?
Oh, I mean, I think the thing is that they come, look, our orchestra comes from 50 musicians from 20 different orchestras from all across the United States, and they're all going through the same things that we're doing here. So we're not really exposing them to anything new. They're doing the same kinds of things, whether it's in Midland, Odessa, Texas, or in Sarasota, Florida, or in Los Angeles, or New York, or Little Rock, Arkansas. You know, the musicians who come from other orchestras are doing this themselves year-round. The outreach means reaching audiences in unusual places. Obviously, education is a huge part of our mission, not as an orchestra, but as individual musicians. We all teach. So I don't think that they shy away from it. I think they're excited. I mean, obviously, many of our musicians have been coming here for 10 to 15 years, some of them. And they feel like Columbia, they spend, 7 weeks of their lives here. That, 13% of their whole life is spent here in Columbia. So they have certainly an invested part of their lives here. So they want to see the community improve and music become a larger part of the community's cultural scene. And so I think that many of them do take very much a vested interest in it, and believe, as Chris and I do, that outreach and reaching these new audiences and broadening our demographics is very important.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to hear you say that all the orchestras are doing this now. This is just the way it has to be. How did that start? Why is that the case? And how long has it been that, I mean, because it hasn't always been that way, has it?
No, I mean, I think there was a turning point in the 90s. There were two turning points in the history of symphony orchestras. One was the late 60s to the mid 70s, when orchestras went from 30-week orchestras to trying to be 45-week orchestras. And the only way they could do this was by employing musicians on a full-time contract. The only way they could employ them or find enough things for them to do was to be involved in education programs and outreach. So suddenly musicians were no longer only playing Brahms and Beethoven, but they were having to go out into the schools and play Peter and the Wolf and do a lot of other things that they weren't traditionally doing. And that move happened in the mid-70s, and I came to America in 75 and was part of that first kind of young conductor's school. The second break was in the mid-90s when the pendulum swung away from so much variety and so much, shall we say, multimedia and almost dumbing down to kids. And then the economy tanked. Mm-hmm. And what happened was that as our traditional audience aged and the economy got worse, orchestras had to realize that they had to find audiences from non-traditional means.
The writing was kind of on the wall there.
Writing was on the wall. I think, you know, some people had seen it in the 70s and 80s coming, but obviously with the 80s boom and the 90s boom, nobody really paid much attention to it until the economy did tank, and then suddenly orchestras said, help, you know, why is it that, you know, nobody's giving us any money? And so we had to broaden our financial support, you know, and
yeah, well, and I guess, yeah, Chris, what other opportunities do you see, I guess, for this, I guess, outreach mission specifically here in Columbia? You've talked a little bit about things you've already been trying to do, but since that's now basically an integral part, it sounds like, of what symphonies need to be doing.
Right, and we're especially challenged here with the Missouri Symphony Orchestra because we are a summer resident program, which mm-hmm. means we gather all these terrific musicians Kirk's talking about and works with are gathering after the school year's out. So at the present time, we don't have the opportunity to move into the schools the way we would like to. But I'll say this, the Music Conservatory, of which we're very proud, right now 158 students in orchestra, in a chamber music program, and chorus, are almost entirely from Columbia, which is great. And that's fantastic. And that's been growing over the years, and we want to keep it growing. But in terms of educational outreach, we're not stopping there. We think it's really important that children, specifically 3rd through 12th graders that want this experience in the surrounding counties, say within a 50, 70-mile radius, but especially the adjacent counties, Audrain, Randolph, Callaway, and so on, they don't have this opportunity. And we are this year, as a matter of fact, chasing grant money that we hope to find out about it in the fall. And when we pursued this, it was with a specific intent, and that's what's been submitted, that we'll use these funds. And, of course, you know, as a nonprofit, we need help from every corner. And we, you know, we're always looking for corporate and grant monies. But we're going to use these funds, should we be awarded them, to sustain an outreach to those communities. And Kirk and orchestral members and local tutors and teachers will be going to those communities like Boonville, Mexico, Fulton, and others, and finding out who those students are. Because we know, just by percentages, there have to be two or three or four kids in each one of those communities that play violin, trumpet, or cello that would love to be on the Missouri Theater in our conservatory and playing in our with our symphony orchestra. So that's another effort that we're pursuing right at this moment.
Okay.
It's a little like what we were saying. I was saying earlier about what we were doing in Indianapolis and talking to the 20-something set. We have to go out to them on their turf, and it's a little like that in reaching young players. You have to go out to them. You can't just hold a ticket, free ticket up and say, come to our theater and come to our concert. I think that this is our goal, is to reach out and go into their schools and find them and then bring them to you. If you just kind of stand there and hold out free tickets all the time, it doesn't necessarily achieve very much, I think, as admirable as free tickets are. I mean, I would love to make the family concerts. You know, if I had, could have a corporate sponsor that would make all of our family concerts free and priceless, I would call them priceless concerts. I think that that would be, you know, the way I would go. I think that we would reach a huge constituency here if we just said these concerts are given to us by our local corporate community.
Well, and that gets to a question we had in the chat room, and it kind of feed into what you're saying here. The person in the chat room says, I love the festival. The music is fantastic, but I can't afford it. The price isn't doable for everyone. Is there a way to make this festival more affordable for those who can't pony up the money? And you're saying maybe there is. It's just kind of having
– I think that, you know, as Chris and I both look at the fundraising opportunities, and I think that the corporate community has got to come and help us here. We have – some new sponsors this year who have come in a very big way, but we have to have new initiatives. And I think that, as I said, it's a process that will take a little while. But if free family concerts, for example, were possible. When I used to conduct the National Symphony in Washington when I was an Exxon conductor, and all of their family concerts are free but by lottery. In other words, you just apply and you can get free ticket to all of their family concerts at the National at the Kennedy Center, and they're always sold out. And I think that, you know, if we could make them free through some process, I would love it to happen. I think it would be good for the community. I think the corporate world would get a great community bonus from it.
Yeah, without question, part of my job is and is going to continue to be to reach out and find new corporate partners, new corporate sponsors as the months and years go on. But
we have to have the kind of initiative that will excite them, right?
Right.
Yeah.
We do. But I will say to that person that wrote in the chat room that what we've got right now isn't too shabby. I mean, out of our 24 concerts in this festival, 7 are absolutely free. And those are the 7 where we're going out into the community. You can hear us this summer. Our opening concert is a free one at Stevens Lake. It's going to be a beautiful evening, we hope. That's June 6th. But anyone else wanting to hear us for free can hear us this summer at Shelter Gardens, at Douglas Park, at Daniel Boone Regional Library, and the Boone County Courthouse Plaza. And further to that, I would mention that our tickets, which we believe are very affordable now, they're $23 and $28, but they're also half of that if you are a student or a child of any age. If you have a student ID, even if you're a grad student at age 24, you can come see our concerts in the Missouri Theater for $11.50. So that's important to us. We're going to maintain that type of price scale while we continue to pursue, as Kirk said, larger corporate sponsors and donors with exciting programs that they'll be interested in and hopefully in the future. All of our family fare will be free.
Well, and it's kind of interesting on the business side of things, I guess, all the different sources of funding you have as a symphony society, right? I mean, I guess in trying to strike a balance because like any healthy portfolio, you don't
exactly
have everything of one type, right?
So, well, that's right. There are 4 primary sources of revenue and income right now. Earned income, which is ticket sales generally. It can be a few other things too. Private donations, where, you know, thankfully we're doing tremendously well at. We've got a really loyal and fantastically generous patron base here in Columbia who has been sustaining us over the last several years. Thirdly, it's corporate donors, what we've just talked about. And fourthly, grant money. Now, the last two we could be doing better at, and that's going to be part of my mission is to improve in those areas. We've already seen some progress this year. They deserve mention on air, so I'll just thank Commerce Bank, Manor Roofing and Restoration, and Shelter Insurance, just to name 3 of the larger ones. They've really come on for us this year. All 3 of them are sponsoring 1 individual concert during this calendar year, and we're grateful for that. And I hope that the next time I'm on your show, I can name 7 or 8 corporate companies in the area who are all sponsoring 1 individual concert. And I think we can do that.
I want to take a moment to remind our listeners that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today we've got the folks behind the Hot Summer Nights Festival in studio. We're talking about this year's program and talking about the future of symphonic orchestras in mid-Missouri and beyond. Joining me in studio are Kirk Trevor, the music director and conductor of the Missouri Symphony Society, and he's the artistic director of the Hot Summer Nights Music Festival, and Chris Campbell, he's the executive director of the Missouri Symphony Society. For you and our audience, are you a supporter of the Missouri Symphony? What led to that decision? We'd love to hear what you think. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. Well, Kirk, you mentioned earlier the big turning points in the history of classical music, and I think popular music has gone through a big one in the last 10 years or so, and that's the digital space, right?
Yep.
iTunes and YouTube and all of that. I wonder what effect that's had on classical music and that medium.
I think probably very similar. We have some slight drawbacks in the instrumental orchestral world. One is the fact that we're still kind of discussing the route in which we will use YouTube. At the moment, the orchestral contract, the CBAs, do not allow us to put more than a 3-minute clip up on YouTube, which makes it impossible for you to, you know, play a whole Beethoven 5 or, you know, whatever piece your new...
Just for royalty's sake, I guess, is the purpose? Or is that
the
problem?
No, it's just our... the CBAs with the musicians generally don't allow for any...
Rebroadcast.
Other than streaming, live streaming is allowed, but rebroadcast, TV rights, and all of those things. It's about royalties, I guess, eventually. But I think that now orchestras are starting to take the attitude: any exposure is good exposure, and the orchestra players and the unions have to probably come to that same point in the understanding that in the long term, for the health of symphonic music, that YouTube needs to become our vehicle as much as it is everybody else's. Let's face it, you know, I mean, all of the individual performers use YouTube, and it's the way that they get their word spread out. The fact is that orchestras, because they don't need a national attention, so to speak, you know, we're not looking for a global audience. We're looking for an audience within Colombia that can come to our concerts. So there's some thinking that we don't necessarily need to become a global audience. We need the audience here in Colombia. But obviously, with the next 20 years, probably meaning that more and more people will use the internet and the digital mediums for their decision-making about where they want to go and who they want to hear, it will become more important for us to be exposed in the same way that every other popular music artist is and every individual artist. And so I think symphony orchestras are going to have to bite that bullet. And we, in fact, in the Missouri Symphony can do it, and I expect we will start doing it very soon, because we don't have the same restriction within our CBA. It's just that I, as a music director, want to make sure that the quality of our broadcast that we put on YouTube are going to be of the highest quality. And so that's just a question of making sure that the audio and the video really are of the absolutely the highest quality, so that we can present. Because once you put it on YouTube, you've gone global. Mm-hmm. And you want people to feel that what's going on in Colombia has some meaning and has a special place.
And Chris, I imagine you kind of are thinking along the same lines.
I am, and what strikes me is we're at a really interesting point in time with Hot Summer Nights, this festival, now in its 10th year, because not everyone knows this, and I've got to keep beating this drum, but it goes along with what Kirk's been talking about regarding the digital age and ways of getting yourself out there. Without having a robust presence right now on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter, and quite admittedly, we don't. That's something I mean to change. I've only been here a handful of weeks, a couple of months now, but we're going to change that, not just because, as Kirk pointed out, we need to start attracting more people in Colombia, but here's the really terrific thing we've got going for us right now. We are, at this very moment, already the largest classical and pops summer music festival in the heartland of the United States. We and this is measured by doing 24 concerts in 6 weeks, and last year attracting 10,000 ticket buyers. 10,000 people saw our 24 concerts last year. Well, that's as big as it gets between Ravinia and Chicago and Aspen at the Aspen Music Festival, two very famous, well-known, established festivals. Well, this is a great opportunity for us. I'm really happy that no one else is doing it quite as well or quite as large as we are in Missouri, Kansas, Iowa, Oklahoma, because it means we've got a niche and we need to build on that. And part of building on that is, as Kirk pointed out, getting some really quality stuff on YouTube, having a robust Twitter and Facebook presence, even though I'll be the first to confess, I would guess 60 or 70% of our current subscriber base doesn't have a Twitter account. That's okay, though. If we're going to expect the next generation of 35 to 45-year-olds to join us and listen to our music, they're on Twitter, they're on Facebook. So, and I want the people in Des Moines and Fayetteville and Leavenworth, Kansas, and Springfield, Illinois, who may hear about us, eventually come see our concerts. Now, I'm not foolish enough to think that because they see something immediately on Facebook or in the media or on the internet or YouTube, they're going to come see us. But you know what? As long as we're growing and we're this largest classical pops and summer music fest in the heartland, if they just hear about us 3 years running and then they finally decide, hey, let's go down to Columbia and take in that historic theater, the Missouri Theater, and see this big new festival, that's worth it, you know, and we need to start planting those seeds now, and we will.
And, you know, the reality is that Columbia already has two big national, international festivals, Roots and Blues and True False. So, you know, our goal and our hope is that we can, you know, be talked about in the same terms as those two festivals, because certainly from the standpoint of being the largest and hopefully, you know, drawing in 10,000 people to the concerts, people should take note of that. I mean, obviously, Roots and Blues and True False have get enormous attention. And hopefully we can kind of stick our hand up and say, wait a minute, you know, we're here too.
Yeah, which it is kind of, it's a little tough since you guys are only, the festival's 6 weeks a year and you've got these other 46 weeks where there's not really anything happening necessarily, but you could maybe, I guess you have a couple case studies to look at here locally.
Well, I mean, we do have our holiday concert during the holiday season in December. We have this conservatory, of course, that is presenting our name out there year round. And the hope is that it might be possible that more of our musicians, as I said, have a vested interest, want to come back to town every now and again, and maybe play a chamber recital and keep the name of the festival going year round. I mean, obviously, we can't have a year round orchestra, but we could certainly have year round performances.
Okay. Well, I wanted to get back to we keep talking about this young audience. So I wanted to talk about that a little bit more too. We talked about it earlier too, but do you think that this program geared toward that younger audience, that new audience, you know, some of this more contemporary stuff? Do you think that would, if you just went to more of that and less of the classical, do you think that would succeed more? Or talk a little bit more about that balance, I guess, and what works, but also what your mission is, I guess.
Well, I think Kirk's going to be the best one to answer that. I'll just start and let him pick it up by saying you can't abandon who you are and what you are to get the newest, latest, and greatest. You know, you have to be true to yourself. And as Kirk said earlier, we are a symphonic orchestra that plays classical music. And the whole idea is not to
play symphonic music.
Symphonic music. That's right. Dare I say classical? Symphonic music. But, right, we programmed a tribute to Elton John this summer. And I hope everybody will that's listening or watching this right now on the internet will go to our website, mosymphonysociety.org, and check out the entire schedule so you know when we're doing the tribute to Elton John and another evening, a tribute to Michael Jackson. But getting to the point, we didn't schedule those so that 3 years from now we could be doing just that. You know, the goal is to entertain people and to approach them with music they like, but also bring them a little closer to the incredibly invigorating and relaxing, and pick any number of adjectives, music that is the classical genre. And as I said earlier in the hour here, people have been with it all their lives. You know, Tom and Jerry cartoons, Warner Brothers cartoons. We've all been listening to Vivaldi and Beethoven and Brahms since a very early age. And people don't always realize that. But no, and I'm going to stop talking and let Kirk pick up the baton. But you can't abandon who you are to get the younger audience. You have to try to do both, and it's a tough balance.
And I think it's also, though, about variety. Mm. I think if we were any one of those genres, then we would immediately kind of close up and become something that was less invigorating and less enticing than the vehicle that we are at the moment, which is a very multifaceted one. And I hope, you know, in the future we're not only talking about multimedia but multidisciplinary. I mean, one of the things I have done in other cities is a lot of silent movies with the orchestra and bringing back to life some old Charlie Chaplin movies and using the orchestra to perform the scores and underscore those. Symphodramas have done Romeo and Juliet, Hamlet, Midsummer Night Dream, combination of play, theater and symphony orchestra together. So I think, you know, the future is very bright as we try to create some new initiatives which are not only multidisciplinary but multimedia. And so the variety issue, I think, is very important. And for the younger audience out there that's listening and watching, I would just say that you can never know until you try it. hopefully, you know, the schedule is varied enough that there's going to be something on there that might pique your fancy. And if you think you're only a pop musician advocate, and you look at Elton John or Michael Jackson as being, you know, passé and old, you know, old fogies in the world of popular music, and some people say, you know, isn't Michael Jackson dead? That's a little bit kind of the way the classical musicians are facing the same thing, right? You know, is popular music only the current trend? Is it only what's happening in the last 6 months? You know, I guess, you know, the thing that we face in popular music is that the decline of popular musicians is much quicker than the decline of classical musicians in many ways. Mm-hmm. But I would just say try it. There's plenty there. You may be surprised. And hopefully as we go through the next 5 years, not only will it become enticing and invigorating in terms of the variety of music that we perform, but the variety of ambience and environments. Mm-hmm. You know, so if you only want to hear us play at Mojo, we may be there sometime, or the Blue Note, or in your local student union bar.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I wonder, too, you mentioned a few examples, but who's when you look at other festivals or other symphonies, who's striking this balance well, and who's got it figured out right now?
Nobody.
Nobody?
Well, I shouldn't say nobody. The thing about summer festivals is that many of them are very specialized. The Cabrillo Music Festival in California. Look, California's California. Hey, Chris is from California, or he's just been in California for a while. You can't compare California and the Midwest. You can't compare the Midwest and New York. You can't compare the Midwest and Atlanta. In many ways, you have to know what your audience is and bring a little of each of those. I would say, you know, California, New York, and the Deep South are different countries, and we can bring them in to the musical styles here. So I would say that we've got a long way to go, but it's about variety and knowing your audience. Hopefully we will know our audience soon.
Well, that's all the time we have for today's Intersection. Thanks to our guests, Kirk Trevor, the music director and conductor of the Missouri Symphony Society, and Chris Campbell, the executive director of Missouri Symphony Society. We'd like to remind you, of those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast, that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday afternoon. You can watch live streaming video of our program each Monday afternoon online at kpi.org. Alongside that video, you can submit your questions and comments and participate in an online discussion with others in the audience. You'll also find an archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is a broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Intersection is produced by Raymond Tungekar, Janet Saidi, Ruben Stern, Vina Rizvik, and Katie Moritz. Travis McMillan's our technical director with production assistance from Eric Stazak. This is his last show. Happy trails, Eric. Pat Akers is our audio producer. Executive directors are Mike Dunn and Mike McKean. And I'm Ryan Famuliner. Thanks for joining us today, and have a great week.